This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
For years, I was so fed up with shampoo, I just stopped washing my hair. I quit completely. I was so sick of poofy, frizzy, limp hair, distorting my natural oils. Until a few months ago, I found Modern Mammals, and it changed everything. And by the way, right now you can visit modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. So check that out. So look, I heard about this through the podcast, and before I agreed to advertise, they sent it to me and I was reluctant. But let me tell you, I should not have been. This stuff is absolutely magical. My hair felt better, smelled way better, and most importantly, looked better. And I know it will do the same for you as well. It doesn't have those hair-ruining chemicals like other products, and it doesn't leave any leftover residues. It works. Don't believe me? Go read their awesome reviews online as well. Go to modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code LSS. Don't forget to use our promo code LSS so they know we sent you. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, Shane Told. It is so great to have you, whether it's the first time you've listened to this podcast or if you're a veteran listener. This is episode number 71. Unbelievable. That's crazy, man. 71 episodes. I've done 71 intros. I'm starting to wonder if they're getting a little repetitive. I think I opened a beer last week. I don't have any gimmicks for you this time. I'm not going to do a deathcore vocal style. I could try. I would just... Well, here's what would happen. If I tried to do it, I would end up doing it so many times and then editing it, and it would sound like we're actually badass and cool, but it would be fake. You know, so I'm not even going to try. However, the guest today definitely knows a thing or two about deathcore vocals. I have Scott Ian Lewis of Carnifex. It was a cool interview. And, you know, a lot of these interviews, I do them in over the phone, over FaceTime or whatever. And a lot of times when I don't do that, I do them in person and I do them like on back of a tour bus, or I talk to Trent from Hands Like Houses in my car. This was actually done in a venue dressing room. I apologize for some of the background noise. At one point, we get our IDs checked, which is pretty funny for a 32-year-old and a 36-year-old, respectively. But I will say, Scott is super sincere, super cool, and really does tell it like it is. And it's a conversation I really enjoyed, and I know you will too. As I record this, I am in downtown Toronto. I am working on a bunch of new music, really keeping busy with that, drinking a lot of scotch, watching a ton of reruns of The Simpsons. And of course, I'm very ready for baseball season, playoffs, basketball, playoff hockey, hopefully for the Toronto Maple Leafs. We shall see. That's what I've been up to. I also am going back on tour with my solo project, River Oaks. This time, we're going out west, doing some shows in Los Angeles, Anaheim, San Diego, Las Vegas. I'm also playing Chicago, which is going to be super, super cool. Tickets on sale now, riveroaksmusic.com. Expect all the River Oaks songs that have ever been recorded. I will play all those. I'll be doing a boatload of Silverstein acoustic songs and, of course, some covers and stuff. Tickets are, like, really cheap. Like, I think it's, like, $12 or $13. So, again, the link is riveroaksmusic.com. Check that out. As always, feel free to get in touch with me if you like the show. If you don't like the show, whatever, I love your feedback. We're on all the social medias. Just search us, Lead Singer Syndrome. You'll find it. It'll pop up, no problem. And also, we have an email address, which I do check all the emails. I don't always get back to everybody because I do get a lot, but I do read them all. And the email address is leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. If you want to leave me a message, you can call the hate line. It's 657-666-HATE. That's right. There's got to be some people that think I'm doing a terrible job and want to let me have it. So that's why we have the hate line set up again. 657-666-HATE. Give me a call. Also, got to give a big shout out to all the sinners. Thank you for being a part of the All Access Club. If you need more content on a monthly basis, if you need more interaction with other fans of the show, with myself, if you want to get some sweet merchandise, the only way to do that is to become a part of the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. Check that out as well. It's leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. And yeah, it's sick. So check it out. Only $6 a month gets you in. And it really does help us keep the lights on around here. Another way you can support the show, if you buy anything on Amazon, please use our Amazon affiliate link. All you do is go to leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. See, it's always the website and then a slash something. So this one is slash Amazon, and that'll take you directly to the Amazon homepage. Login is normal. You won't even know what happened, but anything you buy, the show gets 4-6% of that, and it costs you absolutely nothing. So I don't know. I don't know what holidays are coming up. There's always birthdays. There's always stuff. I don't know. March is kind of a weird month, but I know there's a lot of birthdays coming up in March. I just feel like a lot of people are born in March. I could be wrong. However, use the link. Again, it's leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. Anyways, let's get on to this week's episode and my conversation with Southern California's finest, Mr. Scott Lewis of Carnifex.
Hell shows me.
Center vocal check.
Center vocal check. Can we start right there?
Dude, we'll start right there.
Isn't that the worst part of being a singer? Having to check the microphone over and over again and having to say things? Or is your sound guy pretty fast?
We do work with great engineers, but I don't try to be funny. I just literally stand there and go, hey, 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 one, two, hey, hey, check, check, for until
yes,
they tell me to stop.
I do too. I go, one, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
Yeah.
Microphone.
My days of making a joke of it are over. I just do it.
After you've been doing it for more than 10 years, like, come on. What are you going to do? I used to do stupid things where I'd pick a subject and I'd be like, I'd pick food and I'd start A. I'd go apple, banana, carrot. And I just...
That requires too much thought.
Way too much thought.
I'm usually texting at the same time or writing an email.
Right, man. I'm here with Scott from Carnifex. Nice to have you back in Canada.
Great to be back.
Let's go with the classic, how is the tour going so far question?
The tour is going fantastic, actually, which is not something that can always be said, but this tour is doing quite well, and I'm happy.
And are you guys doing a co-bill with Despised? Is it you guys
headlining? As of today, yeah.
As of today, so it's kind of for the Canadian dates.
Yeah, well, I guess... I mean, they're closing that out, but it's mm-hmm. COVID. You know how that stuff goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the most part, yeah.
We're working together. We're a team here. It's a team effort.
Team effort, yeah.
It was cool because, like, you know, we've known the Despised guys for a long time. They took us out a long time ago. We went to Europe with them for the first time.
Yep.
It was cool. I just hit up Alex and... we just made it happen and
cool. Kind
of just made it work where, you know, the managers and the agents and
right. Everyone
was, what about this? What about that? We're like, we'll figure it out. We'll make it work.
Sure. No, that's great. And, what are your thoughts in Canada? I know you guys are from San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously you're American, whatever. Usually Americans tend to like Canada. I think it's cute. But also being from San Diego, like growing up, you never experienced any kind of winter weather, did you?
No, I grew up in Los Angeles, and then my family moved right before I went into junior high.
Yeah.
My weather went from great in LA to better in San Diego. So, I was never physically in snow until I went on tour.
Right. I just imagine that. Like we did a record one time with a guy, Cameron Webb, who's a producer from, I guess he's from, like, grew up in Newport Beach. And it was the same thing. He came up here to do one of our records. It's like dead of winter.
It's culture shock.
And he's like, I don't know. Like,
because we, you know, we rent a car for him, whatever. He's like, I've never driven the snowman. I don't know if I can do it.
Yeah.
And this guy's like 30, 35. He's not a kid.
Right.
He's like freaking out. So I just imagine you guys being like, all right, we're doing our first like wintery tour, East Coast, whatever, February. What was that like for you guys as a bunch of kids from Southern California?
Well, probably much like you, man, I spent my entire 20s on the road. I started touring when I was 21. So it was like, not only was I like growing up just in general and surviving my 20s, but I was on the road for all of it. So it was kind of like figuring out how to drive with a van and trailer in the snow was just one more thing on a very long list of like make it to the next day, you know, and it was like
get through it.
Yeah, it was like finding out what winter tires are. We didn't know this was a thing. We just thought there was tires.
Yep.
And then you get out there and they're like, well, what about your winter tires? We're like, we got the tire. I don't know. What winter tires are you talking about? So I know it seems bizarre, but it was just stuff we never encountered. Like so many things, you know, the snow is, I guess, a good analogy for so many other things that you just didn't know about.
Right. Right. I like that. It is funny too, man, how you go from, there's this transition, right? Where you go from being excited, your kids, you're in a van, and you never think about like a career.
No.
You think about, do we have enough money to get to the next show? Do we have like some place to sleep? Yeah. We don't really care where, just someplace.
No.
And is there like anyone at the shows? And then eventually, as your band gets bigger and bigger, you know, you get spoiled in some ways. But there's never like a defining moment when that happens, is there? Or do you think there is?
No, I think it's incremental. I think you go from like being so happy to even have a show to play.
Right.
And then it's, we're playing out of town. I remember the first time, I still remember like the first time we played out of San Diego.
Yeah.
And that was like a thing. That was cool. You know, we like got all our friends together. We're like, we all got to go up there, you know, and make this big show. We played up in Orange County and we played in Fullerton. And it's just incremental. And then I remember the first time we had a good merch night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember? And it was like $300. But that was like, you know, normally it's like you would sell like four shirts.
Sure.
And that's just is what it is, you know? Because we were open up for national acts and just playing backyard shows and those types of things. But I remember the first time when we made $300 on merch. I couldn't believe it, you know? And that, I remember those little steps of just getting there. And I remember when we finally got like a real trailer and we were like, so I remember the first tour we did where we had like our double axle, like big, like drop gate trailer.
Right.
And everyone else
like
has got their
6x12 or whatever.
Oh yeah. Well, 7x12. Yeah. Everyone has their little shot ass trailers and we roll up on the tour. And we got the real trailer. I remember that moment, you know, and it's like, it's just incremental. You get there bit by bit and then it's like, now, like this tour, you know, I do all the accounting for the band and the business for the band. It's like this tour was like our biggest merch order ever,
right?
You know what I mean? So now there's that milestone. I have a $48,000 merch bill waiting for me at home, you know? So it's like there's always like these little markers, you know, and it's like it's cool because we've been around for 12 years, but like we had such a slow crawl,
right?
Like we really struggled for so long, and it's not like we made it now, but things are more, I guess, consistent at least.
Absolutely, that's a great way to put it. And I always felt like your band, I want to start from the beginning actually, but I always felt like your band had a bit of a rough like ride in terms of like people taking you guys seriously.
Oh, you're nail on the head.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe that stems a little bit from the Victory thing, which is obviously a huge thing my band went through. We did 4 records with Victory. So maybe that's where it stems from, but let's go even further back. And like, obviously you say you're from Los Angeles, originally moved to San Diego. How did you get into becoming a metal singer? I mean, for lack of a better term, like what were you got? Obviously, you got some heard some band. You got decided you wanted to.
Well,
be a part of something.
It was actually theater. You know, I was in drama, like drama class at school, and live theater was something I was always interested in.
Okay.
You know, I there's a lot of musicals I watched as a kid that impacted me. I remember just my only sort of friend group or clique group was the live theater group.
Right.
So like when we would do the plays, I just, you know, I was always around people that were performing and creating some type of art, you know?
Right.
And granted, you know, junior high school plays are probably walking the line of art. But the point was, I was around people getting on stage and doing something that people watched.
Right.
And then from there, it turned into me trying to be a drummer and being okay enough to jam with garage bands.
Yeah.
And then just realized that I was more drawn to writing and sort of like the creative aspect of it outside of the technicality of the music. More like,
right,
more of like the emotional aspect.
Ooh,
of songwriting.
We got a little dance party going on here. This is wonderful. Sorry, continue.
Like the more, you know, as a vocalist, I'm not sure if you play an instrument.
Yeah, I play guitar and okay. Some drums and bass.
So like I consider myself a songwriter, but more in like almost the producer aspect rather than the I'm going to pick up a guitar and play a riff.
Yeah.
What I can do is I can sit down with musicians and put together a song. That's my skill set.
Right.
So it's like I kind of was more drawn to that early on, and maybe I didn't have like the instrumental gift.
Yep.
Rather than like I kind of had the ear gift, if sure. That makes any sense.
I absolutely get it. I totally get it.
Yeah. So that was kind of there early on. I think I always just liked writing and telling stories.
Yep.
And, you know, like the adventure movies of the 80s were like huge for me.
Cool.
So that kind of instilled this idea to want to like just have narrative, you know, and talk absolutely. About things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So at this time you're talking about junior high and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What was your family structure like? Did you have like your parents together? Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah. So I had an older sister. She had her own set of struggles. I had a much younger brother that, you know, everything was great, but he was just much younger than mm-hmm. me, so there was not a whole lot of, like, social interaction.
Right.
Like,
yep.
We didn't share a friend group or anything like
right.
that. My parents were fairly strict early on until they got divorced. They got divorced when I was 14, and then it was then it was the free-for-all, no rules
right.
after that.
Right.
And subsequently, I ended up dropping out of high school a few years after when I was 16. And that was when I really sort of left the live theater and just did all bands.
Right.
And I just was, that's when I just started doing bands. And I tried real hard to like, I don't know that make a career. I don't think I thought in terms of make a career in a band, but I tried real hard to be in a band that I thought sounded good at least. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so it was like Carnifex in terms of your, you know, you say you start touring at 21, 16 is when you started with bands. Were you pretty much with the same kind of guys or were you in a bunch of different bands in high school?
I mean, you know how it is. I think it's like one or two guys are like always in the band. Like it's
right,
a different
right.
dude, like, but it's like always like someone that was in that. Because
there's like
band.
One really good drummer or maybe two drummers in the whole scene. Yeah.
Right.
Course.
So
especially in metal.
Yeah. So it was pretty incestuous as far as band members go.
Right.
And yeah, it was just, you know, you try to make it happen and, you know, like there's always, pardon me, there's always a guy that's like this dedicated and there's the guy that like, I don't want to give up my Saturday night and
sure.
you know how it goes. So you just go through that process and I got to the point where I sort of just, you know, it ran its course at about 19 and I was working quite a bit and just, you know, that was that. And then I met Sean a year after that when I was 20, and we started Carnifex in August of 2005.
There you go.
Yeah.
And here we are. It's been a meandering road.
Tell me about it.
For you guys. Now, obviously, we have a big common thing to talk about here, both being Victory alumni artists.
Both survivors.
Did you put four records out?
We did three.
We did four as well. We did four. Now, did you guys finish your deal? How did it work? Because there was a bit of a hiatus thing. I'm kind of wondering. Actually, let's start with how did you first get hooked up with Victory? How did that happen?
We were on tour with Amir in June of 2007.
Right.
And Victory came out to a show to watch them play, and we were on the tour with them.
Oh, wow.
So they gave them an offer like the week after that, and they gave us an offer in September. So June, just was that 2.5, 3 months?
Right.
So, yeah. And back then, you know, you're clueless. We did the total clueless 21-year-old sign a contract without a lawyer thing.
Oh, boy.
Basically, it was Darkest Hours on Victory.
Right.
Between a Buried and Me's on Victory. Our friends in Amir, pardon me, are on Victory.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just signed to Victory. So when you get a, when you go from doing your debut record, which we did on like a total indie for $600, that was our budget, $600. Damn. I know, right? And then you see a contract that says $20,000. Right. You're like, why wouldn't we sign
right.
this? You look at all the bands that are on it.
Right.
Our friends just signed. And Amir was blowing up right then.
Yeah.
So we saw how good they were doing. And it was like, this is what we need to do. Duh. Sure.
Right? Yeah. But you must have heard some of the horror stories. I mean.
No. No.
Like, you can just Google it, really. Like,
I mean.
Maybe not in the metal. Like, there weren't all the metal bands you mentioned. But, of course, like, there was the whole thing with, like, well, Treyu. Southern California band. They had, you know, I think at that point, was this like...
I guess you think that like, those are big bands. They have their own problems. That's not us.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because it's like, they're a Treyu. Like, oh, there's probably like big lawyer and management and they're selling millions of records and like, well, that what does that have to do with us?
Right.
We're just a metal band. Like, we're never going to be that bad. So why does...
But well, you know. That's the same thing that happened with Silverstein.
Yeah, I mean,
I remember we were in the studio. We were doing our debut record for Victory.
Uh-huh.
We only had like $10,000. That was only our budget. Which at the time the exchange rate, it was great because it was like 60. It was like 160. So it was like $16,000 to make a record, which was pretty good.
Hey, that works out.
So I remember we were in the studio and Taking Back Sunday had just crossed 100,000 records sold.
Oh wow.
And that's like for us, we're like that's crazy. That never happened to us. And we said to our producer, if we ever sell 100,000, if this record sells 100,000, we'll like buy you this like crazy amp we were using or whatever. The record sold well over 100,000 copies, and we never bought him the fucking amp.
Oh come
what
on!
A,
now.
What a bunch of pricks!
Come
we
on!
Thought,
now.
Oh, we're like, oh, when we sell 100,000 records, we'll be swimming in money, dude. We'll be like, you know,
yeah, right.
But that's not how it works. It's I know you guys sold probably 100,000 records too over the course of your career
with Victory. Yeah, I mean, we sold 90,000 with Victory between the three records, and you know the record prior I think is at 28,000, which was huge for an indie.
Solid.
That's why they came to us with the money, is that you know we had the MySpace hype was like real, and it like you could sell records because of MySpace in 2007, and we did. We you know that first record sold quite a bit. We never got a check from them ever. I mean, we got our checks for the studio,
right?
Well, we didn't, the people did. That you know, because our budget was entirely went to the studio.
Well, they need what do you want to call it? Like an inventory. Like they need they need a product
to
sell. So of course they have to pay those people.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've heard of Victory stiffing like producers before. I don't know if it's all true. It's hearsay, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, I know the guys we worked with got paid. That's all I can attest to. Yeah, I mean, I could tell you, like I said, 90,000 records on. And I never got a check from them.
Well, you've been pretty candid in some interviews about being like. I mean, I've heard you call Victory a shit label.
Have I?
I mean,
maybe that was our drummer.
Maybe it was.
I try to be a little more diplomatic.
Okay, I can respect that. Then I'm sorry to put words in your mouth like that. But you know, how did it all shake out with Victory? Were there a lot of problems, and how did you end up moving on from the label, and now you're still here, and you still have a great career?
Yeah, I just think that, I think that, you know, when you sign a band, you should let them do them, and mm-hmm. We were very restricted in things we were able to do. Not necessarily directly, but it's just like the amount of money that we had and how far it had to go.
Yeah.
It means you can only pick from this pool of producers. It means you can only shoot these kind of music videos.
Yeah.
And it was just limiting, and that's, I'm not saying that we need some blank check to go out and do it. But to use an example, with Nuclear Blast, we went to them. We had a, you know, hey, they gave us X amount of dollars for music videos.
Right.
I wrote up some treatments. I sat down with the label manager, who's an amazing guy, like really a guy that gets it, and said, look, this is going to cost more, but here's where it's going. This is what we believe in. Like, this is the way to put the record. He looked through and he's like, no, we're on board. Yeah. What do you need? We'll do it. And then guess what? We had to, best first week chart ever, and when our career should be in the shitter because we're a MySpace band that's been out around for 12 years on record six. Like, we should have been done
right
like 5 years ago, you know?
So then, man? Oh, really? This is cool.
I'm not drinking, if that matters.
You still gotta make sure you can be identified worst case scenario, right?
I'm an old man, 32.
This
there
has
you
never
go.
Happened
you
know, in the middle of my podcast
you're
before.
You're a few months older than I am. I'm not an old man. I'm not an old man either, right?
Well, yeah. Now my age is on the podcast.
There you go.
I'm a mess.
Try and find a light spot.
There you go.
Perfect.
Thank you, my friend.
Have a good show, guys.
There we go. This shit's real, man. I'm not gonna edit that either. This is real. The struggle is real.
Yeah.
But I mean, you talk about the stuff like, yeah, best first week, record six.
Yeah.
Nuclear Blast and Nuclear Blast, not as big a label as Victory, not even close.
Well, they are now.
Right now they are.
I will put one little aside in there.
Yeah.
Globally, they've always been bigger.
That's fair. Absolutely.
Dude, I've been to that German office, and you're like, what's this band I've never heard of? Yeah, 3 million records sold. You're like, well, that's crazy. And then you look over here, and it's like some giant photo they blew up of them that sold out. You're like, I didn't know Epica sold out 20,000 tickets in Germany. Yeah.
Well,
turns out they do.
Germany is crazy. I don't know if you guys have done like Rock and Ring or those festivals and stuff.
We have. Not like, that particular one, but we have done some big ones.
Some of the big ones there, and like you'll look at the headliners, they'll be like, who the fuck is In Extremo? You know what I mean? Like some band headlining, and they're just like this massive German band. And it's like
massive.
The weirdest music. But it, you know, they know what they're doing over there, man, for sure.
They do.
But I mean, my question was, you see the success you can have if you put a little into it,
yeah,
a little bit of money, and a label that's understanding the direction. There must be a, I don't want to say regret because it's a strong word, but there must be like fuck if on our second record or third record. We really could do what we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could be.
You know, we've had that conversation in the band, and I've had that conversation with myself. And it's one of those things where, like, I look at the Victory experience, and it had its challenges, without question. It had a lot of challenges. Yeah. But it also kind of was like a refined in the fire type of thing. Like, it really made us the band we are today. And it wasn't...
It gives you a resiliency.
It does. And it makes you... It makes you figure out how to find a way, you know? So because of that, we learned a lot of lessons because of that experience. And they were hard lessons, but we learned them. And I think, you know, like, things like when a label comes to you and says, oh, hey, we want the record this time. Previously, we were kind of like, well, I guess that's when we have to do it. But with NB, it was like, when are you guys thinking about doing a record? And we go, well, we need time to write. So we waited 28 months, which for bands like us, you get it, the agents, I can't 28 months. You guys got to give me a record quicker than that. I can't put you out.
Right.
I need a record every 16 months, you know?
Right.
And it just doesn't work for us. You know what I mean? Like, we're slow riders.
Yeah.
B, we're huge re-riders. See, we tour a shitload, and we do not ride on the road because
we don't ride on the road either.
We just look at when you're your own crew, and I mean, we're doing a bus on this tour, yes, but all the other tours, we've done a van. We do our own driving. We push our own gear. Like, we usually TM ourselves. We usually just bring a sound engineer and a merch person, you know?
Right.
And it's like, there's no, and look, I mean, okay, you can't, the listeners can't see it, but we're in a backstage room, and it's nowhere to pull your guitar out and track riffs.
Not really, man.
And this is the everyday, you know, this is the norm. So riding on the road doesn't work. So I think part of the reason those NB records have done so well was, NB knows what the fuck they're doing. And they know when to let an artist do his thing and, like, trust their vision and say, okay, we're behind it. But also is... we know, we knew, like, look, we need to give ourselves time. And they trusted us with that. Yeah. And look at the results we got. We got Die Without Hope, which was our second best first week, was our first best until, you know, until Slow Death came out. And it's just a great team effort of them knowing when to hang back and them knowing when to come in and support us.
Do you think the hiatus helped you, though? Like taking whatever it was, like a year?
It helped me up here.
Right.
You know, I was kind of fucked up too. I was going through a lot of personal stuff, so it was like I sort of lost my vision for what I was even doing.
Your direction.
Yeah, like what is this band? What's the thesis of Carnifex? Like, why am I here? Why am I on stage? What am I talking about? Mm-hmm. What do we mean to the people that are listening? What are we trying to say? I sort of lost that.
This thing's got convoluted and when you're thinking about like you're saying you do the business of the band, you're doing the, you're worrying about all these logistical things and not thinking about the creative side.
Yeah, and it was just like, we were having a lot of problems on the business side, and it was just like we went from being, you know, jamming in Sean's bedroom to where we were, and we never got a second to stop and process it all and be like, where are we now? Where are we going?
Right.
And the hiatus enabled us to do that. Where are we now? Where are we going? What do we want to do? Like, before it was always just survive. That was our existence. Get to the next day, get this tour, sell this merch.
Right.
That's it. That was what all we thought in terms of. And then when we had the break, you got, it probably sounds pretentious, but it was like, you was able to like, be like, what's the vision here? What are we trying to say? What do we want to be?
Yeah.
You know, and that was where, like, I think that's partially why people are responding to the records more.
Sure. Well, what did you do personally for whatever it was, a year?
Yeah, it was 18 months. We were off the road. I wrote, me and Sean wrote Die Without Hope together, just like we wrote Dead in My Arms together. And it was just me going over to his apartment, and he'd play riffs. And I'd say, that's cool. That sucks. That's cool. That sucks. Mm-hmm. So that's how we wrote Die Without Hope. And then I was working... I was working for a guy named Paul Conroy, a name you might know.
Yeah.
He at the time, he was managing some business assets for Rob Dyrdek, the skater, and he had a athlete management company called Crush Sports Management, and I was working for them.
Right.
Doing athlete management. I was like a day-to-day guy for Paul and another agent that worked there, a guy named Keith.
Different world,
same exact.
Are you a sports guy?
I like hockey.
Oh, well, you're in the right place.
Kings fan. And I like MMA, although it's like totally, I'm like pretty liberal, so it's like completely opposite of what you would think. It's like such a meathead sport. But I do like MMA for whatever reason.
Sure.
And so they were managing MMA fighters.
Okay.
And they were managing like X Games athletes.
Right.
So it was...
So not mainstream sports.
Well, I mean...
Well, you know what I mean. MMA, you know what I mean, though. Not like baseball players or...
No, it wasn't. Kind of it wasn't like NBA, NFL type stuff. But yeah, so it was a different medium. But a lot of the things that I did as like a tour manager... And like dealing with agents and managers in the band capacity was a lot of very similar things in that job.
That's entertainment too, right?
It was really the same thing. People go somewhere, they need stuff done, there's an itinerary, get this guy on flights. It's like all the same stuff. You're just not sending them to a venue, you're sending them to like the X Games or the whatever. Yeah. You know, it's a lot of the same stuff. So there was a lot of parallels where that was a pretty easy position to step into. And the guy that I was working for directly, who was a really great guy, he had just stepped away from being a manager for a lot of bands as well.
Right.
So we both came from the same world. Paul, obviously, was from the music world.
Was Good Fight? Was that his company?
Initially, he was with Good Fight, or Channel Zero as well.
Okay. Yeah. No, I know he stepped away from band management, and so that's interesting. Yeah, I remember I went to Leafs game this year, and they played the Kings, and I believe... It was 7-0 Kings. We got crushed.
The Kings are very manic. They will go crush a team, and you're like, yeah. And then you'll be like, I'll be on IG, and I'll see like the results, and I'll be like, 1-5 to the Coyotes. What the fuck?
Well, yeah.
What have you done?
They're kind of a slow team. I mean, Ginla. They got a Ginla, right? That's kind of a crazy pickup.
Yeah.
He's an old man.
But. Yeah, and they're a team that I really feel like just sort of messes around in the early season, and then when he gets close to playoffs, they're like, I guess we should win some games. They did that in 12 when they won the cup. They were like, the whole beginning of the season was like a disaster, and then they just eked by every step of the way.
But that was when they were the 8th seed.
Yeah.
And they were down, weren't they down 3-0, and they came back and won the cup?
Against the Ducks. Yeah, I'm just like,
insane.
You're stressing me out here. Like, they lose every game possible, and then just win them all in a row. You're like, okay, that's cool, but don't do that again.
I'm glad we do this a lot on the podcast, where we go off on tangents and talk about random sports games. But back to the hiatus and, you know, we talked about the success you guys had recently with your records charting higher and stuff. Do you think going away, people were like, maybe people took your band for granted a little bit? Like, as we talked about early on, you were always sort of the under-the-radar band. You maybe weren't getting on the coolest tours. You maybe weren't getting...
Or if we were, we were one of.
Sure, things like that. You weren't getting treated amazingly.
No.
But you have real fans.
We do.
And when all of a sudden you guys are like, yeah, you know, we're gone. Or whatever, we're taking a break. We don't know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Scott's got to get his shit together.
Yeah.
Where the fans, like, when you guys were finally back, they're like, oh, fuck. Like, we need to support this band. We missed this band. This band is actually special. Do you think there was an element of that to it?
I definitely do. You know, there's that, what was that movie where they said going out of business is good for business?
Right.
I think there's something to that. And also, I think it was all those things you said. And when we came back, I think it was a good record. So I think it was like everything together. I think we came back with a shot.
Label.
Yeah, great label too. I think if we came back with a shot record, it probably wouldn't have mattered. But thankfully, we were able to write a record that connected, and the label like believed in us, which was awesome. And we also like had a great agent that like believed in us too, and a great manager, and like we just got fortunate that people like that kind of knew like we were always like in the fight, like the good guys. When we came back, and then it's like now we have this label that's really like behind the band. That was like, I think, changed a lot of people's attitudes about us.
For sure. Well, there's also the whole like, I mean, you guys have been like called, labeled a like deathcore band. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you care about that label. If that was even, that probably wasn't even a label when you started the band. So
in 2005, it was not.
No, but you know, your style of music that you guys are associated with, it's kind of gone the way of screamo, like my band. And there's always the like,
dead,
there's only a couple bands left in some of these genres, and you're one of them. So you come back after 18 months, and it's like, oh fuck, like
hold on to them.
We're still here, and then a lot of bands that you probably were touring were gone. Is that ever thought in your mind about
absolutely
that, or do you kind of just ignore it?
No, it's a thought, man. I mean, look at the landscape from when we started and when we got some notoriety, 05, 06. Who is still around from then? Like, it's Suicide Silence. Whitechapel, I mean, they started about a year and a half after us, but yes, Whitechapel, and then Despise is, you know,
sure. Well,
is back on, but it's on again, off again. Yeah. So it's like, who else? Like, all those heavy hitters are gone. Job is gone. All Shall Perish is gone.
Right.
You know, like, you name them. All those big MySpace bands, they just are done, you know, for what different reasons. And, I mean, it is how we made it. I don't know. Maybe being under the radar and being on Victory was like the blessing in disguise because people didn't get burned out on us. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, like, this is the thing. This is why we talk about this shit. This, like, it's interesting, man. Like, you know, I always talk, like, when I talk to bigger artists and stuff on this show, a lot of them have had, like, previous success, like, huge song on the radio. They sold all these records, and a lot of those bands really don't last.
Yeah.
Because when you have this hype, whether it's MySpace hype or radio hype or whatever hype, you you get a lot of fake fucks coming to your show.
Sure.
A lot of people that are there because it's cool, because right. it's the latest thing. I'm going to wear a Carnifex shirt because, not because I really like the band, but because this chick I think is hot, thinks right. the band's cool, you know? And eventually that style goes away, and in this, whether if there's no substance, it doesn't matter, right? So yeah. I feel like with your band, you've had the substance, so you've been able to maintain a good level with real fans coming out. I mean, I was just standing in line yeah. waiting for you to come out and get me. It's just like every kid's wearing a Carnifex shirt, like,
well, that's
they're
good
stoked,
to hear.
Man. They're stoked.
Yeah, you know, we do have real fans, and I think what's funny, I think some of the reason we have real fans is something we got a lot of shit for in the beginning, which is because my lyric style is very different than most deathcore bands, especially deathcore bands from our era. The 05, 06 deathcore bands were all about, like, sort of the Cannibal Corpse worship lyrics, and I never took that approach. I always wrote these sort of, like, emo lyrics, but they could have been, like... You know, they could have been like, you know, Thursday lyrics, essentially.
Right.
I mean, maybe, you know, he's probably not dropping as many F-bombs, but it was more about, like, personal. I wrote about personal shit.
Right.
I didn't write about, like, hacking people up right. and stuff like that. I could never relate to that. And kind of going back to, like, how I ended up here, like, I was drawn to narrative through feeling a connection through the movies I saw and the human emotions in those films. And so... And then also my early musical influences, like Nine Inch Nails and like the grunge bands.
Man, and now I gotta stop you at Nine Inch Nails. Nine Inch Nails, probably for me, biggest lyrical influence.
Oh, yeah.
No one talks about how great Nine Inch Nails lyrics are.
They're fantastic. And they saved my life. And that's a true story. I had a lot of lows in my life where literally having Trent's voice in my ear saying what I'm feeling and going like, well, I guess I'm not the only person that feels like this. At least I can listen to Trent.
Wow.
You know, that was huge for me. And so I think I felt like compelled, probably through hero worship, but also just through like going back to like, why am I here to like write about something that matters? Now, granted, when you're writing your first record, you don't really know how to do that. So lyrics are probably garbage, but the intent was there.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. and now many years later, I feel like I do know how to not only write a good song musically, but lyrically, I feel like I can write something that conveys the emotion I want to convey.
Crazy. Yeah. No. Are you, when you write lyrics, what's your approach? Do you like, do you just kind of sit on your couch and work? Are you a fast writer? Are you a slow writer?
I'm a cumulative writer. I write all the time.
Right? And you're a journal guy.
Squirrel it away. Mm-hmm. And then I work so much with the music process. So immediately when I'm getting riffs, I'm already like attaching little lyric ideas to it. And then I'll go in and me and Sean do all the arranging. We'll arrange a song and then I'll already kind of have an idea of what that song is going to be and what lyrics are going to live with that song. And then it's kind of a middle out process. I'll build my choruses. It's like, those are my main points. I really want to focus on
right.
lyrics here that are relatable, memorable, but have the little hook in them,
right.
you know?
Sure.
And then I'll fill out the verses once I have those anchors with the theme that the song is.
It's funny, that's probably the smart way to do it and the right way to do it, but I think a lot of people are like, what's the first line of the song? And they start there and then it kind of builds. And then, you know, I always tell people when they ask about, how do I write lyrics, and I always say, like, stay away from the perfect rhymes.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, the fire and desire.
Sure.
Like, and when you start writing, because then what happens is instead of you writing the song writes you.
Yeah, you're just trying to find a word that rhymes.
You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, that's not the perfect line for what I want to say, but it's okay.
But it's
next
okay.
line. And then you get so far off track.
Right.
So I think you're right. When you start with a chorus that's the main idea, then you can really work it backwards and be like, okay, how are these two verses or verse and bridge, whatever it is, how are they going to relate to my point? Which is, hey, you're teaching me things. It's good.
Yeah, I think what it is because, like, when I think in terms of story, you know, because when I write, whether I'm writing a script or something that's like in a novel type form, you don't, the first scene is not necessarily what you see in your head, and then you don't come to like the big reveal on page 68. You kind of have the big reveal in your head. You're like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if like this thing happened, and then you figure out, how do I get to that thing?
Right.
And it's sort of the same approach with the songwriting. It's like, I really like this chorus. This says something. Okay, cool. Now I just got to get myself there. Yeah. I have my destination. Now yeah. I just got to get there. Mm-hmm. And so when I, you know, when I'm writing outside of music, I, it's the same approach. I have my concept, my theme, and my big moments.
Right.
Just like, you know, you have your big moments in your movies. You're like, your Oscar speeches or whatever, right? And you just got to get yourself there. Everything else is just the scenes to get you there. You know, I've heard, it was, I can't think of the director now. I wish I could remember his name and give him the credit for it. But basically, what he was saying was like, look, like, you don't write a movie from page one. All you do is think of these moments, these human moments, and then you just get yourself there and get yourself to the next one. And that's kind of that approach with choruses. Not to say the verses don't matter, but it's a similar process. Like, the choruses are what matter, and I just got to get myself there.
You there know? You go. It's cool. I'm exposing all my secrets. No, I'm thinking about now, like, you're talking about how your lyrics are different than a lot of bands in deathcore, and they're, I mean, they're obviously just so much more relatable. Like, who can really relate to... Like, I mean, I love Cannibal Corpse as much as the next guy, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I'm not, like, listening to Fucked with a Knife and being like, oh, yeah, this is...
Sure.
This was my last Saturday night. Like, where yeah, that's, I that's my heart broken. Buddy. Like, yeah. That's not, you know, it's more of a fact. So I wonder if that makes fans have a deeper connection to your band.
It does.
It's possible.
I believe that it does, and I believe that it draws a different kind of fan.
Yeah.
Not to take anything away from anybody's fan base.
Oh, I want Corpse Grinder on the show, man, so bad. That's
Corpse Grinder is actually a good friend.
Can you put in a good word for me?
I will.
Because I'm a huge Cannibal fan.
So. We did the tour with them last summer, and then we did a European tour with them. And they're honestly, like, those guys have the least amount of rock star.
Oh, I believe it.
Ever. They're just five dudes still playing metal, no egos, no rock star. I just, like, we always joke, like, if we ever make it to like 45 and we're still playing metal, let's just be like those guys. Right? It's so nice, and it's no BS, you know.
I love it.
But yeah, it's like, I just try to write stuff that someone's gonna listen to and be like, I feel the same way.
You know? Right on, man. That's awesome. I also want to ask a little bit about, before I let you go, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, I know.
Yeah, I'm going
to
go.
Show about to go on food. And everything. But just vocally, like, your vocal approach, your style, singing, do you have, I always love to ask metal guys, like, can you sing at all? Like, clean singing? Like, or are you just a fucking full-on screamer?
You know, I did some singing when I did the theater group.
Right.
And I guess the term singing is probably pretty relative at this point. I don't know. I probably could do some form. I can carry a note. But like screaming, it would probably take me a while to get confident with it.
Yeah.
I think a big thing about, you know, I am happy with the voice I have on stage. And a big part of that is you have to have the confidence to believe in that voice and push that voice. And it's the same thing with theater. Like, when you're, the biggest hurdle for like a new person on stage when you're young is that confidence to project. And in that projection is where you really find your voice. You know, when you just go all in. Think of like the timid drummer. It wouldn't work.
Right, it wouldn't work.
You gotta go ham. That's the only way the drums sound good. And similar for the vocals, not necessarily in effort, but in mentality.
Yeah.
Like, you have to believe in your voice. And when you believe in your voice, I think that's where you get the sounds you want as a vocalist, whether you're singing or screaming.
Yeah.
I believe in my voice as a screamer so I can get what I want. And it would take me some time to believe my voice as a singer, but I think I could get there if I needed to.
Would you ever try to do a different kind of musical project? Like, is that something you're interested in doing, or is it just all Carnifex?
Probably all Carnifex. Carnifex is my baby. You know, I started Carnifex. It's like, I live it, I breathe it, I don't get a second away from it. I don't know if I have the energy to do another band and, like, deal with booking shows and write. Like,
already so much to...
Yeah. My bandwidth for music is already full. I'm really focusing on film and television writing and this graphic novel I'm doing.
Oh,
so
cool.
Talk
about that a little bit. Can people check that out?
Yeah, so it's the script for the manuscript for the graphic novel is finished. Right now I'm working with a production company that does comics and has a stable of artists and inkers and all those people that are going to help me adapt it from script form into all the panels. And I'm hoping to have it out in the summer.
Cool.
But it's my first time. It's a long process. It may end up being the fall.
Sure. Great, man. Well, hey, thanks again for taking your time. And hope you have a great show tonight.
Thank you very much.
Make my people proud in Toronto.
Oh, we'll bring the show. Yeah, if anyone wants to follow me online, Instagram, at Scott Ian Lewis.
Scott Ian?
I know, same name.
Scott Ian Lewis, at yeah. Scott Ian Lewis. There yeah. it is. Yeah, follow him. He takes nice pictures and he loves hockey, so there you go. Thanks, man.
Appreciate Thank you it. For having me. Appreciate it.
Dude, thanks, man.
All right. Hey, great.
That's cool.
Whoop, there it is with Scott. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Oh, man, he's just honest guy. Loved this conversation. Loved him talking about songwriting. That was super cool, too. Definitely, if you're an aspiring writer, there's definitely some great shit in there. He spilled his secrets. He even said it. So thanks a lot to Scott for doing this last minute. And thanks to Mike Mowry for setting it up. Next week, we will be back, as always, Monday. Make sure you're subscribed. And again, if you like the show, help us spread the word. Tell a friend, tell a loved one, tell your mom, tell your dad. I don't know, maybe they're deathcore fans. Who knows? We do all different kinds of music on Lead Singer Syndrome. The only thing that's the common denominator is it has to be a lead singer. I will leave you with the tune. As always, this is probably the heaviest shit I've ever played at the end of an episode. So fasten your seatbelts. Here's Carnifex with Die Without Hope on Lead Singer Syndrome. I'll see you next week. Get in a shallow grave. Well, hey, you're still here. Oh, it's so nice that you stuck around through the whole metal song to hear me talk about one last thing, which is the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. I kept it short in the intro, but if you got this far, I'm sure you are a big fan of the show. You've probably listened to other episodes. Thank you so much. And I really just want to tell you one more time about what the All Access Club really is. I'll ask you to check out the link, leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. Now, there's, I believe, four different tiers that go all the way from $6 up to $75 per month. Subscribing, and you can get all different kinds of stuff. You get access to the merch store. We have some really, really cool stuff. It's in stock right now. We've got t-shirts, we've got hoodies, we've got enamel pins, we've got mugs. And the only way you can get that stuff is if you're a member of the club. And the merch is actually pretty cheap too. So you will, you know, we're going to make some money, obviously, in the long run. And that's the point of this, is for the support. If you like the show, it is free. I do this out of the goodness of my heart, but it would be nice to be able to make some money and you know, be able to grow this thing and be able to do some special things with it. Another perk of being a part of the All Access Club, the longer you remember, the more stuff you get. If you're part of the $9 tier, every 3 months, you get stuff sent to your house. And the longer you remember, you get more and more stuff as a thank you. But probably the coolest thing is the bonus content. And every month, you get a bonus episode with a non-lead singer. Also, a bunch of stuff, me talking to my friends. I actually did one this week where I'm talking to my mom. So, just to get an insight into my life. Some people are interested in that. If you're not, well, hey, you don't even have to listen to those episodes. Also, a really, probably my favorite part is the Facebook group. And we now have 175 members on there. Pretty much all day it's going on. We've organized events. There was an event in Stockholm, which was really cool. There's an upcoming event in Texas, which is going to be really, really special. So if you join the club, be a sinner. It is really, really fun. And I guarantee you, you'll make a lot of friends. And it really is a great group on there. Shout out to everybody, all the new members especially, but of course, all the people holding down the fort over on the Facebook group, and I love you all. That's all. I just wanted to make sure you guys checked out that link. So that's all I ask. You don't have to sign up. I know it's not for everybody. The show will always be free, so don't worry about that. But hey, if you want to help out, the link is leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. Thanks a lot for listening to me rant, and we'll see you next Monday.